Today, the phony wars. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 21st of July 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here is the link, and I'll add it to the comments below. It's important to look past the headlines and examine the data, because we need to see the truth behind. Let's start with the housing market this week. Auction clearance rates and volumes continue to fall, and Sydney recorded the lowest clearance rate the city has seen since December 2012. CoreLogic says that last week saw 1,178 homes taken to auction across the capital cities, and they returned a clearance rate of 52%. Compare this with 52.6% across 1,411 auctions last week, and 69.4% on 1,627 homes this time last year. Melbourne's final clearance rate came in at 56.2% across 559 auctions last week. And that's similar to the previous week, when 631 auctions were held and the clearance rate reached 56.1%. This time last year, auction volumes were higher across the city, with 756 homes going under the hammer and returning a clearance rate of 74.9%. Sydney's final clearance rate dropped to 46.9% last week across 408 auctions, the lowest clearance rate the city has seen since December 2012. In comparison, 552 auctions were held across Sydney over the previous week and returned a clearance rate of 50.1%, while this time last year, 609 homes went under the hammer and they returned a clearance rate of 69.2%. Across the smaller auction markets, clearance rates improved everywhere except Brisbane. In terms of volumes, Adelaide was the only city to see an increase, with an additional 8 homes taken to auction over the week. Of the non-capital city markets, the Hunter region recorded a 70.6% final auction clearance rate across 17 results, followed closely by Geelong, where 70.4% of the 27 auction results were successful. CoreLogic says auction activity is expected to remain relatively subdued this week, with 1,155 homes scheduled for auction across the combined capital cities, similar to last week. And they also reported that home prices slid further across all the centres other than Brisbane, down another 0.11% in the past week. So there's absolutely no indication of any improvement. Now, today I had the chance to visit 5 auctions in our area, none sold, and no one serious made any bids at 3 of the events. But this should come as no surprise, as credit is still less available than a few months ago. Indeed, around 40% of households seeking to refinance their mortgages have been knocked back, compared with just 5% a year ago. We discussed these findings as part of our analysis of household financial confidence, which overall was lower again. See our post, Household Financial Confidence on the Brink Again. The June 2018 edition of the index, which draws information from our rolling household surveys, registered just 89.7, well below the 100 neutral setting and down from 90.2 last month. Debt remains a major issue, with mortgages being on the front line. Households remain highly leveraged. Some households with lower loan-to-value ratios have been able to switch to other cheaper loans. And we also continue to see many households adding to their overall debt via credit cards or other loans. The new positive credit environment, which commenced 1 July 2018, will change the game ahead, and credit may become even harder to source for some. On the other hand, households continue to dip into their savings to maintain lifestyle and budgets. And significantly, more than one-third of households with an owner-occupied mortgage had savings less than the equivalent of 1 month's mortgage repayment. The other two-thirds had significantly larger resources, which would insulate them in the downturn, at least for a time. CoreLogic has looked at the changes in property values by area from their peaks, with Perth showing a 28% fall alongside Darwin, Brisbane down 12.5%, Adelaide down 7.4%, Canberra down 6.8%, Sydney down 5.3%, and Melbourne down just 0.9%. But over the past decade, home values fell on average 27% across Mackay in Queensland and more than 34% across the Western Australian outback. These are big falls and puts the movements in Sydney and Melbourne into perspective, or perhaps provides a better view of where we're headed. S&P Global Ratings did a job on the banks this week, saying they recently negatively revised their view of the Australian banking sector's industry risk. Developments over the past 2 years in the Australian banking sector, including information coming out of the hearings at the Royal Commission, highlight some weaknesses in the effectiveness of regulation in the banking sector and the conduct, governance, and risk appetite shown by the Australian banks. We think this is a big deal, as we discussed in our post, and now for the bad news, at least for the banks. In addition, the latest S&P Ratings Spin Index to May 2018, based on their portfolio of mortgage-backed securities, showed a further move up in the defaults compared with last month from 1.36% to 1.38%. There were rises in New South Wales of 0.02%, Queensland of 0.04%, and the Northern Territories up 0.52%. Significantly, the larger hikes were seen in the major bank portfolios, with the prime spin rising from 1.36% last month to 1.38% in May. And there was a rise, particularly in the 61 to 90 day past due loans, from 0.22% last time to 0.25%. While these moves are small, arrears are now as high as they were back in 2011. And remember that interest rates are much lower today, so this highlights the risks in the system. This does not, by the way, appear to be a seasonal issue either. It is more structural. In addition, personal insolvencies were higher again, according to the Australian Financial Security Authority, who released their statistics for 2017-18 and the June quarter 2018. The data reveals a sharp rise in total personal insolvencies to the highest level since the global financial crisis a decade ago, with record high insolvencies reached in Western Australia and the Northern Territories, and debt agreements also hitting an all-time high. The pressure on households continues to bite. Even the RBA minutes out this week discuss the problem. And the latest SQM research data on rentals also showed that Sydney vacancy rates are the highest in 13 years at 2.8%, potentially putting more pressure on property investors in the city. We also ran some alternative mortgage scenarios this week, showing that even if income started to move up to, let's say, 3%, that's 1% higher than now, the number of households struggling with their finances would remain well above the long-term trend. We remain, as a nation, highly exposed to debt, especially if interest rates rise. And you can watch our video on this analysis, Alternative Mortgage Stress Scenarios. Even CBA's Gareth Aird, their senior economist, in a fairly bullish piece, admitted that for many households, the number one headwind that they face with respect to consumption is debt repayment. Australia has one of the most indebted household sectors globally, he said. Debt-to-income ratios have risen from around 148% in the mid-2012s to a record high of 190% in 2018. This measure includes all households, regardless of whether they have actually a mortgage or not. For households that have a mortgage, that figure, he said, is significantly higher. It has steadily increased as interest rates have come down, despite lower rates making it easier to repay debt. Basically, growth in the net flow of credit, i.e. new credit, less repayments, has been higher than growth in income. He says a high debt burden relative to income acts as a constraint on future household consumption growth. It means that interest payments as a share of income are higher than otherwise. And of course, the principal must be repaid too. This leaves households with less income that can be spent on goods and services. And it means that households have a much greater sensitivity to interest rate changes. From a demographic perspective, he said, it's the younger households feeling the debt burden most acutely. And there is also about $120 billion of interest-only loans in aggregate that are scheduled to roll over to principal and interest loans annually over the next 3 years. Borrowers shifting to principal interest loans will face higher mortgage monthly repayments. I could have not put that better myself. The plight of households in the current environment even reached New York in an excellent piece in the New York Times called Australian Housing Costs Rival New York's, but boom may be ending. I was quoted extensively. We are on the edge of a precipice, says Martin North, Principal Analyst for Digital Finance Analytics, an independent research and advisory firm. All of the forces that have driven the home sector and the debt sector higher in the last 20 years are coming to a critical inflection point. Almost everywhere you look, you can see icebergs. Of the 3.5 million mortgages where the owner lives in the home, almost one third of households have incomes close to or less than their expenditures, and he predicts that at least 50,000 households may default in the coming 12 months. Now, if you want to get deep and dirty into our analysis and the potential consequences for Australian households and some potential mitigation strategies, then you might want to watch the recording of our live stream from last Tuesday. It's just over an hour in length, and we had some excellent interactions in the chat room. In fact, there are two versions available: the live edition, which includes the real-time chat, and, by the way, the odd technical glitch, it does help to turn the sound on, or the slightly shorter version at a higher quality, and it's been tidied up, but without the chat. You can choose. We plan more live events down the track, and the links are below. The apparent bright spot this week was the latest employment data, which was above market expectations. The number of people employed rose 50,900 from May to June in seasonally adjusted terms, which was well ahead of forecasts of around 16,500 people. And that wasn't just a lot of new part-time jobs. Full-time employment rose by 41,200. On a year-on-year basis, that represents an increase in employment of 2.8%. But even then, the number of people unemployed fell from 715,200 in May to 714,100 in June. This is explained by the participation rate, the proportion of people participating or trying to participate in the paid labour market. The participation rate rose from 65.5% in May to 65.7% in June, leaving the unemployment rate unchanged at 5.4%. The Australian labour force participation rate is actually pretty high. A useful comparison is with the United States, probably the world's most robust labour market, where the current rate is 62.9%. The key point is that if more people are going to come into the labour market when it looks better, as they've been doing consistently, then a continued reduction in the unemployment rate is going to require creating a whole lot more jobs. And in any case, the basis for counting employed people is suspect. We discussed this in our post, and now for the good news. Little signs of wage growth at the moment. The local stock markets had a pretty good week again, with the ASX All Ords up 0.35% on Friday to 6,377. The S&P ASX 100 was up 0.38% to 5,168, encouraged by the unemployment data and the economic news from China. Westpac, the largest investment mortgage lender, was up 0.67% to $29.90, but well below its 12-month highs. And CBA rose 0.68% to $75.90, but again, well below prices from a year ago. The overhang from the Royal Commission, tighter funding, and higher risks explain why they are priced down. Looking across to the US markets, the earnings season was in full flight for the week, and the majority hit or beat Wall Street expectations. The Dow Jones Industrial Index was down 0.3% to 25,058 on Friday, and the S&P 500 fell just a little to 2,801. The Volatility Index, the VIX, was also a little lower, but remains above its level last year. The financial sector continues to perform well. Morgan Stanley led the broker dealer reports, and Goldman Sachs also topped estimates, although concerns about its succession plan hit the stock later in the day. But even so, these stocks are off their 12-month highs. And Macquarie Bank, in comparison, has been performing more strongly in our local markets, up 0.84% on Friday to $125.40. On the tech-heavy Nasdaq, which fell just a little on Friday, down 0.07% to 7,820, it was a tale of two techs, as a momentum stock fell short of what investors wanted and an old stalwart came through. Netflix tumbled at the start of the week after the company missed expectations on new subscribers, a key metric for the streaming company. Netflix added 5.14 million subscribers in the latest quarter, shy of the analysts' expectations of more than 6.2 million. But after the bell on Thursday, Microsoft reported second quarter earnings that beat consensus, thanks to cloud services revenue. The prospect for the path of US interest rates took an interesting turn at the end of the week. At first, things seemed to jibe with market expectations, when the Federal Reserve will raise rates once and possibly twice before the year is out. At his Humphrey Hawkins testimony before the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell reiterated the central bank should gradually increase interest rates. But President Donald Trump shook some of the market's confidence, saying on Thursday that he was not thrilled about the Fed hiking rates, and going on more specifically on Friday on Twitter. The tweets had little overall impact on the market forecast for upcoming rate hikes, though. But they did take the legs from the dollar on Friday. The US Treasury Department has long held a policy of simply stating that a strong dollar is in best interests. The yield curves continue to converge across the long and short term, and this is often seen as an early warning of trouble ahead. This from Bloomberg.
For right now. So yeah, when it comes to the yield curve though, people were really worried that an inversion would mean recession. Have we gotten any more clarity from him on where we're headed?
We have not. So I won't say that the yield curve inverting is a broken indicator, but I think it's not necessarily representative of the economy that we are in the here and now. So for late cycle indicators, we like looking at M&A activity, we like looking at volatility, equity issuance, skew. And I would say, you know, the 20 or so indicators we look at, half are saying late cycle, half are saying mid-cycle, which isn't the most helpful, but I think it means that we're at the beginning of the end of the cycle.
The 30-year bond is sitting at 3.03% and the 3-month at 1.98%. The 3-month LIBOR remains above 2.3% and the 10-year benchmark is at 2.9%, just a little off its highs. And this also is reflected in a lower BBSW rate in Australia, suggesting a small fall in margin pressure for the banks compared with a few weeks ago. Trade war concerns took a back seat through most of the week, but were revived on Friday and could weigh more heavily next week, despite another full earnings calendar. President Trump said in an interview on CNBC that he's ready to impose tariffs on $500 billion worth of Chinese goods to the US if China does not back down on its trade policies. "I'm not doing this for politics, I'm doing this to do the right thing for our country," he said on CNBC's Squawk Box. We've been ripped off by China for a long time. In fact, Moody's highlighted that already the trade wars is hitting base metal prices, yet it's hardly mentioned. Since worries surrounding a trade war came to the fore, the base metal price index has sunk by 13%. The copper futures are well down from their highs a couple of months back, and so is steel. This could crimp Australian GDP in the months ahead. And both gold and silver were weaker, suggesting that at the moment, risk investors are preferring the US dollar to valuable metals. It's also worth noting the Chinese yuan slid against the US dollar and the Australian dollar. And some are suggesting that this is a sign of the Chinese government answering the trade wars by taking their currency lower and so reducing the cost of their goods in the local economies. Crude oil prices posted a second straight weekly decline and may continue to weigh on energy stocks as they have been of late. On the New York Mercantile Exchange, crude futures for September delivery rose 1.30 to settle at $70.46 a barrel on Friday. Investors continue to weigh up the prospect of a global shortage in supplies, despite Saudi Arabia's pledge to hold off flooding the market with more output. That said, Crude oil prices were supported on Friday by the plunge in the dollar following Trump's remarks about the greenback and other currencies. Bitcoin lifted a little and continues in a less volatile mode, though well below earlier highs. And finally for today, another lens on the debt bomb, as featured in our recent discussions with economist John Adams, including those on the debt bomb itself, the international debt bubble, and more recently, the meaning of money. We have more planned, so watch out for these. And there is also a dedicated webpage on the DFA blog. Again, the link is below. The McKinsey Global Institute says that since the GFC, many large corporates around the world have shifted towards bond financing as commercial bank lending has been subdued. Today, they said 19% of total global corporate debt is in the form of bonds, nearly double the share in 2007. Annual non-financial corporate bond issuance has increased 2.5 times from $800 billion in 2007 to $2 trillion in 2017. The global value of corporate bonds outstanding has increased 2.7 times since 2007 to $11.7 trillion, doubling as a share of GDP. The average quality of blue chip borrowers has declined. In the United States, almost 40% of non-financial corporate bonds are now just rated BBB, just one notch above speculative grade junk bonds. Growth in speculative grade bonds has been particularly strong. Globally, the value of corporate high yield bonds outstanding increased from $500 billion in 2007 to $1.9 trillion in 2017. And in the coming 5 years, an unprecedented amount of these bonds will come due. Bond issuance by companies in China and other developing countries has soared. The value of China's non-financial corporate bonds outstanding rose from $69 billion in 2007 to $2 trillion at the end of 2017, making China one of the largest bond markets in the world. Outside China, growth has been strongest in Brazil, Chile, Mexico, and Russia. From 2018 to 2022, a record number of bonds between $1.6 trillion and $2.1 trillion annually will mature. Globally, a total of $7.9 trillion worth of bonds will come due during these 5 years, based on bonds already issued. However, some bonds have maturities of less than 5 years and may still be issued and come due during that period. If current issuance trends continue, then as much as $10 trillion worth of bonds will come due over the next 5 years. At least $3 trillion of this will be from US corporations, $1.7 trillion from Chinese companies, and $1.7 trillion from Western European companies. But now, overlay the rising interest rate environment, and you can see the problem. Such high leverage will cost the global economy dear, and sooner rather than later. If you like what you've heard here today, please like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the Growing Band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst of Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.